Thank you all for noting coming to the summit this time around, but also being with us this morning. We think we have an excellent program this morning. Of course, we're a little biased, but we have three of our top leaders in our industry, and this is an opportunity that not too many people get. So you're in for a very interesting and a very unique opportunity. I will be your humble moderator for the panel this morning. I'll try and stay humble, although I'm sure that'll be difficult as we go along. So I will introduce all the panelists at one time here now. I will ask that you hold your applause until I have finished all three introductions, and then we'll give them a nice round of applause and a welcome. A couple of housekeeping things. Each of the panelists will speak for about 10 minutes. And then I have a couple questions for each of the panelists. And while we're doing that, there are some yellow cards, hopefully on the table near you. But if you can't find a yellow card, I am willing to accept, because I am your humble moderator, I am willing to accept questions on the white note cards, too. So I'm very flexible. Only thing I ask is print or write so I can read them. And I'm also going to help Mr. Starkey with the second panel in the same way. Your questions would be encouraged on the cards or the white note pad. It doesn't mean you can't raise your hand and ask your question, but if we can do note cards, it'll help me organize the questions in terms of, you know, we have three questions on why don't we produce more chicken or whatever. So that's sort of the lay of the land this morning. Let me now introduce each of the panelists. Let me also note that in the back there are the introductions, if you will, for the panelists. And so if you don't understand what I'm saying about them and you like more details, and I think the contact information is on that sheet too, so if you would like to get more information on who the panelists are, we do have handouts in the back there. Our first panelist is Lamkin Butts, President and Chief Executive Officer of Sanderson Farms. Lamkin has served as Chairman of the National Chicken Council during 2011-2012. And he, as you all well know, his company was very gracious and opened their doors yesterday to what I thought was really an excellent tour. And we had a lot of interesting interaction. And when you think about Lamkin's responsibilities, that was one location. He has nine other locations that he needs to worry about every day. So he has 10 locations like the one we saw yesterday that he needs to figure out how to keep them going and at the end of the day and maybe the end of the quarter, end of the year, have enough money to pay for the high-priced corn and some of the other costs that we'll hear about this morning. Lamkin has been the president and CEO of Sanderson Farms since November 2004, been with the company since 1973, even longer than I have been with the National Chicken Council, so congratulations, Lamkin. He worked his way up from processing division manager, director of processing and sales, vice president of sales, and he was elected to the board of directors of Sanderson Farms in 1998. He has served on the National Chicken Council board since 2004 and also on the board of the U.S. Poultry and Egg Association and the Mississippi Poultry Association. He is very active in his local community and a number of other activities in his area. So that is Lamkin. On your program, you'll see our second panelist was supposed to be Sarah Lilligren with Tyson Foods. And if you've been watching the news, or at least the weather part of the news, you have seen there's been a strong storm move through the Midwest, and that storm prevented Sarah from connecting on her flights, and so she apologized that she could not be with us today, but she tried very hard to be here with us, so she asked that I extend her apologies to you, but the storm just prevented her from being with us this morning, which means we'll have more time for questions to the folks you see here behind me. Our next panelist is Bill Lovett. Bill Lovett is President and Chief Executive Officer of Pilgrim's Corporation, and he was elected the National Chicken Council Chairman
in October of last year, and he is currently serving as our chairman. Bill joined Pilgrims as president and chief executive officer in January 2011. He has served as president and chief operating officer of Case Foods for 2 years before joining Pilgrim. He worked 25 years with Tyson Foods in senior management, and he was involved in international business and food service, senior group vice president of poultry and prepared foods. Began his poultry career in 1982, so he's a newcomer, with a company called Valmac. One of the things about the industry is we continue to get bigger, but we have fewer players. But back when some of us started with the industry, there was a great company called Valmac, but they consolidated with Tyson Foods. And Bill has served in a number of industry positions, both National Chicken Council, U.S. Poultry and Egg Association, and International Food Service Manufacturers Association. Our third panelist is, as we say, no stranger to us, Jim Perdue. Jim is chairman and chief executive officer of Perdue Farms. In 1991, Jim was named chairman of the Perdue's board of directors, and he became the third generation Perdue to lead the company. Jim holds a doctorate in fisheries from Washington, University of Washington. I'm not sure there are too many leaders in our industry who head up companies who usually have a degree in poultry science or something. Jim is not only a chicken expert, he's also an aquaculture expert. So, during his boyhood, Jim worked alongside both his father and grandfather and helped build the business. In 1983, he joined the Perdue Farms in an entry-level management position. In the early 90s, Jim appeared with his father, Frank, in many of the company's television commercials, so hopefully you've had an opportunity to see some of those. Those were, to me, some of the more interesting advertisements on television, not just in the chicken world, but across the advertising world. Under Jim's leadership, the strategy and focus has been to more and more differentiate their products from the competition, and I think some of the competitors would agree that he's done a pretty good job of making the Perdue brand a little different than the other companies. And like our other panelists, Jim is very, very involved in his local community and church activities and a number of other organizations outside the chicken industry. So if you would now join me in giving a very warm welcome to our three panelists. And as I mentioned, each of the panelists will take about 10 minutes or so of opening comments, then have a couple questions for them. And while we're doing that, make sure you're thinking about what questions you'd like, and we'll gather those, and we'll get the Q&A part started, which I think will be, from your perspective, the important part, so we can hear from you as to what's on your mind. Okay, so, Lampkin, you're up.
Thank you, Bill. And, excuse me. Good morning to each of you.
Good morning.
I'd like to begin by thanking you for your attendance here and your participation. I enjoyed visiting with a number of you yesterday and last night, and I think the most common, most familiar comment I heard was, you were very brave to open your operations to this group of guests. And I too want to say I think you were very brave to come here and be with us on that tour. But I would like to say that the reason we were comfortable with that venue is that it's not that we've done this before with a group of food writers or food critics, but we do often take a guest through a plant. It could be a politician that's never been in a plant or a hatchery or on a farm, or it could be a new customer, it could be a local politician, things like that. But in every case, it's always been a positive experience, and so it made us very comfortable with proceeding with this. So thank you again for being here. We've enjoyed it thoroughly. I'll just mention to you briefly where our industry is as far as supply and demand and what we see possibly in the future for us. We never know. We never know the vision and the window to see is short. Chicken prices can change and surprise us overnight, as can grain prices. And those two items affect our business the most of all the factors that we deal with. since 2005, we've been faced with a different market for corn. Corn and soybean meal make up, corn is about two-thirds and soybean meal one-third of our feed rations, and that is the largest contributor of all we do toward the cost of our product. And the corn market has changed because of the amount of corn being used to make ethanol. Last year, and the projections are that this year, over 40% of the corn crop will be converted to ethanol. that has happened because the government created the renewable fuel standard, and the refineries are required by law to make that much ethanol. And corn is the only raw material available in large quantities that allows them to do that. So it's actually an issue with us in Washington, and Mike Brown and his crew work on it every day. We'd like for the government to get out of that subsidy. We do not, as an industry, we do not object to competing with ethanol for corn. We understand competition, but we would like for it to be on a level playing field and get the government out of that and let the markets dictate where that corn should go. The government has backed away from the blender's tax credit. They have reduced or eliminated the tariff on imports. So the message is getting there in Washington, but the renewable fuel standard is the main issue left on the table to deal with. The impact on us is, as an industry, is that for 25 years, the corn prices were $2.50 to $3 a bushel. And last year, corn was over $8 a bushel. It's been, and in the most recent times, because freight and basis, the basis is the cost to book that grain, and the supplier guarantee supply is so high. In August, we peaked in August of last year. We Sanderson, we paid over $9 a bushel delivered to our mills for corn. Now that was the peak, that was the worst. We've been over $8 for most of this year. The board is down to about $6.50 right now. And but still, you're over, if by the time you get that to the mill, you're over $7 a bushel. So that is what we've been faced with. And as a result of that, our industry's actually shrunk. From in 2007, our industry was setting, y'all saw egg sets yesterday, so now y'all know what that number means, egg sets. That's the number of eggs that we put in that incubator as an industry. USDA publishes the number. They get the data from every hatchery in the United States and weekly tell you how many eggs go in those incubators. In 2007, our industry, some weeks, was setting 220 million eggs a week, an average for the whole year of 215 million. Today, we're setting, as an industry, 200 million eggs a week. So our industry has actually shrunk. It's almost 10%, which, it's not a comfortable feeling for us. We don't like that. We per capita consumption of chicken has been growing, not so much during this recession since 7 and 8, but over a long term. So we're more comfortable with that number being higher. But at that number, at 200 million eggs, even with the $8 corn, right now most companies in our industry are profitable. Just getting there, weren't there all of last year's and even in the first quarter of this year, but today's market, because of that supply number, prices have improved enough that most companies are profitable. We believe that right now it looks like the summer is going to be a good market for our industry. But the potential, we believe, is this. There are two things that have caused us to shrink. I mentioned corn and grain prices. But the other thing is just the recession and the high unemployment and the economy that has changed since 2007 and 2008. And that reflects on demand, particularly from restaurants. Because of high unemployment, people go out to eat less, and there's less demand from restaurants. And we're feeling that in our business. Between that and high prices for corn, our industry has shrunk. So it also means that the potential is, and we believe that one day this economy will return to a more normal economy. We believe that unemployment will go down. It'll take time, and I'm not predicting when. But when that happens, people will return to normal lifestyles, and demand will return. We also believe that we didn't do it last year because of a drought, but one year we'll have a normal corn crop. The farmers are committed to a lot of acres because of high prices of corn, and we'll get some relief on the cost side. The optimistic part of me says if we get both of those at the same time, it would be a nice ride for the industry. So that's our outlook, and we're very positive about that for the future.
Thank you, Lampkin.
So thank you again for being here, and again, I want to extend our appreciation to Sanderson Farms for the great tour yesterday, and I'm sure you enjoyed it as much as I did. Lampkin, I'm glad you got that subject. Even happier than me is our investor relations head, Rosemary Geeling, in the back. We're coming upon a couple of weeks of our earnings release, and she's always nervous when I get up in public like this and make comments. So I'm going to talk to you about the global outlook for poultry. Lampkin touched on perhaps some of the more domestic issues in terms of supply and demand. I'm going to sort of take it to a more global look. Before I get into my content, though, I discovered a very, very good opening this morning at our breakfast table. So I think it's fair to say that we've really had a good time the last couple of days, right? We've seen a lot, we've learned a lot, and there's a lot of anticipation about, you know, how we're going to do as good or better next year. And I can tell you the industry from a facilities and management perspective, we're going to have a tall order to surpass what you saw with Lampkin's company yesterday. But the venue is even more interesting because I mentioned at our table, I'm living in Colorado now, and we our great populace in Colorado voted to pass legalization of marijuana recently in the last election. And when I mentioned that, I began getting very heavily lobbied to have the venue in Colorado next year. So I think that may tell you something about the company we're keeping here. But, yeah, the bad news, we won't get to see a lot of chickens in Colorado, but it may be an interesting venue should we decide to have it. So I want to talk about the global outlook, and I want to make a case for why the outlook for chicken today is really good, but the future, I think, can look even brighter. And I think we only have to look really to a couple of slides. If you can see that, that may be a busy slide, but basically what it shows you is that if you go back to 1960, we had about 3 billion people on the planet. Today, we have a little bit more than double than that, 7 billion people on the planet. And it's projected that by 2050, we're going to have something in the order of 9 billion people. So just in the matter of about 100 years, we're going to triple the population on the globe. A lot of the information I'm going to present today, actually, you saw a little bit in Bill Weldon's presentation Wednesday night. Matter of fact, as I was watching that, I think we probably used the same sources on some of our information. Now, the interesting thing about the growth of the population is where it's occurring, as opposed to the fact that it is occurring. It's occurring in many developing countries, developing economies, and I think that that's going to bode well for the demand of protein globally, and that's really the crux of what I'm going to present today. If you look at meat consumption forecast, the one thing that I'll point you to on this slide is that while pork is going to grow and beef and lamb are going to basically tread water, maybe grow a tad, the fact of the matter is chicken is going to by far grow the most of any of the commercially available proteins. As Lampkin alluded to earlier, in the U.S., our industry's grown at a CAGR of about 3% until just a few years ago, about 2006, 2007, and we've actually gone the other direction. I would submit to you that, as Lampkin said, that's not a good thing when we have to consider the population's growing and therefore the demand for chickens growing. 81% of the growth of demand for protein is going to come from developing countries and not countries such as the U.S. And I'm going to show you a couple of slides that give you a good picture of that. Basically, what we see on this slide is the growth is coming from Africa, Asia, Middle East, even some in South America, not so much in the U.S. And I think if you think about the reason for that, it's pretty clear. In the more developed economies, we're already eating much more protein than the rest of the world. Why is that? Because we have much more disposable income. And anytime, it's been proven in economic studies, anytime a population improves their disposable income, the first thing they do is improve their diet. And most of the diets in people in developing countries have come from cereal-based or grain-based diets. And the first thing they do to improve that diet is they include more protein. And it doesn't take much, a very large inclusion rate of protein to really ramp up demand globally. So that's the growth story or the demand story. On the other hand, let's look at supply along with demand. And it may be hard to see in the back, but there are different colors on this map. If you see, I think that's a blue chicken, both in the U.S. and Brazil, and then you have red chickens as well. Really, all that means is blue is a surplus, red is just the opposite. So we have a deficit. And so you can see that basically in Brazil and the U.S., or the blue chickens, the red chickens are basically the rest of the world. If you go back to the slide before, you'll note that most of the growth for protein consumption is going to be here where there's not a surplus of chicken. And I'll get into the reasons for that in a few moments, but I think that's something we have to take note of. Mentioning the U.S. and Brazil, let's look at some numbers in terms of our production and our global share. The U.S. is the largest country on the planet in terms of producing chicken with a global market share of about 20%. China produces about 17% of the global share, and Brazil is third at 15%. Now, the interesting thing is if you go to the slide next to that, you'll see really it comes down to U.S. and Brazil in terms of global trade. And the reason for that is China's industry is basically a domestic industry. They export very little of their poultry production. And their demand for poultry is growing at a much higher rate, so they're actually importing a lot of their needs. And so between Brazil and the U.S., that captures about two-thirds of the total supply for the rest of the world in terms of global movement of chicken. And again, I'll get into the more specific reasons for that in a second, but I think this slide demonstrates that the U.S. and Brazil are basically going to supply chicken for the rest of the world in terms of volume. So U.S. exports, we export now about 20% of our production. And historically, and our export business is really changing as we speak. Historically, we've exported the parts of the chicken that we don't consume heavily in the U.S. And it's been mostly dark meat. We call it dark meat, the back half of the chicken, the legs. As our population grew and as we consume more chicken from the last 40 years back, most of our consumption growth in this country has been of breast meat. We are seeing more growth today in dark meat, even here domestically, but there's a couple of things about people outside the U.S. Number one, their preference is on the leg meat. And number two, historically, the leg meat, because of our consumption patterns here in the U.S., the leg meat has been less costly from a market standpoint. Now, I would submit to you that's we're in the throes of a change of that value shift. If you go back to 2005, about 53% of the revenue of U.S. chicken was produced by the front half, or the breast meat, actually. If you look at 2012, that had gone down to about 37%. And if you look at where on the bird that revenue has shifted, a lot of it has shifted to wings, a lot of it has shifted to the back half and other parts. So the breast meat is sort of losing revenue share, and the back half is gaining revenue share. I would tell you that I think that's going to continue here in the U.S. for a couple of reasons. Demographics are changing here in the U.S. We have a growing Hispanic population who has a preference for leg meat. And while the Asian population in sheer numbers is not near as big, the Asian culture, I think, over-indexes in terms of its influence on our eating patterns and in our diet. So I think we'll continue to see a shift in demand from white meat to dark meat. Our exports, getting back to this slide, our exports have definitely grown from 1990, where we exported only 1.1 billion pounds of product, up to 7.3 billion pounds this past year. And USDA estimates that we'll grow that again about 3%. In the coming year from last year. And then the final slide that I want to show you really is talking about, well, why is all this occurring? Why will the U.S. and Brazil, but primarily the U.S., why will we be the global supplier of chicken around the world? Well, three reasons that I can think of. One is value and affordability. So the one thing that we know from yesterday is the two ingredients that you have to have in abundant quantities and relatively cheap, as opposed to world prices, is corn and soybean meal. And the U.S. Produces a lot of corn and soybean meal relative to the rest of the globe. If you look at the other country that produces the most corn and soybean meal besides the U.S., guess what? It's Brazil. So that allows us to have a very affordable product as opposed to some of the other proteins and as compared to other parts of the world. If you think about it, if you just use the simple ratio of 2 pounds of feed for a pound of live chicken, and if you're in a country that really doesn't grow a lot of feed grains, then you'd have to import double the weight in feed grains as you produce chicken. And that's not efficient, obviously. The second reason is our product is extremely wholesome, extremely nutritious, and extremely safe. I would tell you that with our federal system of inspection, it produces the safest, most wholesome, most nutritious product on the planet. We implemented HACCP in 1997. And for those of us who went through that, I can tell you it was not an easy transition from the methods that we used before. And I would tell you that the methods we used before HACCP were very effective. But I would tell you that since the implementation of HACCP in the late 90s, we've gotten better and better and better each year. And we're not satisfied with where we are today. Even though we have the safest product on the planet, we're still striving each and every day to make our product more wholesome, more safe, and we're not going to let up in our relentlessness to continue to make sure that our products are safe and wholesome. And then the final reason is our distribution and logistics system. We have a very, very efficient distribution system here in the U.S. We get corn and soybean meal to our feed mills much more efficiently than does Brazil. Brazil does not have the rail infrastructure like we do in the U.S. And as a matter of fact, in their ports, when their corn harvest came off in March, they had a 15-day line of trucks waiting to unload at the ports. That would never happen here in the U.S. with our logistics system such as it is. We're able to get product out of our country much more efficiently than any other country in the world. And we have protein companies now that are involved in all proteins, and we're on basically all the planet in terms of our market presence. And so we're in tune to what's happening in Kazakhstan, for example, in Western Africa, for example, and in Asia, for example. And we're tailoring our products to meet the needs of those consumers. So those are the primary reasons that I believe the U.S. will continue to feed the world in terms of chicken. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. And let me just mention that Bill's comments were very candid, and the reason I use the word candid is many of you may be aware of Pilgrim's is owned by a Brazilian company called JBS, and so I was interested to see how candid you were going to be, Bill, in terms of comparing Brazil with the United States. I think you did a good job of laying it out in a pretty straightforward manner. So thank you again, Bill. Jim, you're next.
Yeah. And I want to extend my welcome and appreciate Lampy for your hospitality. And I think Tom Super might get, this is a great venue this year, and something we ought to build on. Maybe in Colorado, you might be able to see chickens if you. Never mind. But I was asked to talk on corporate sustainability and responsibility. You know, when you think about it, it helps. You think of the bumper sticker that says it's, you know, think globally and act locally, where sustainability is thinking globally and responsibility is acting locally. And here's a statistic you haven't heard, I'm sure, except for Bill the other night and Bill here, where the population is expected to be by 2040, 2050, 9 billion people, 2 billion more people. And as Bill said, they're going to be in those developing countries. 80% of that growth is going to be in those in developing countries, emerging countries. I mean, so you know, and at the current rate of production, where we are now, we're going to need 1.5 worlds to feed that many people. And unfortunately, we only have one world to work with. You know, so the challenge again is for trying to figure out how to feed 9 billion people, you know, without increasing agriculture's environmental footprint. And yesterday you got a glimpse of modern agriculture with Lampkin's operations. And there's those that would argue that today's production agriculture is not sustainable, and I certainly would disagree. But certainly we can't go back to the agricultural practices at a time when the population was only 1.5 billion if we expect to feed 9 billion people in the coming years. And you know, it would I think be arrogant in a sense of claiming that what works here in North Carolina and what you saw yesterday is the only way you can do it. You know, there's a lot of different ways to grow chickens. Here's another way of doing it, and there's no single production system that's exclusive on sustainability. And there's no one right way to raise poultry. So the question really is, you know, what is the right way to produce food, and how do we do all work together to sustainably feed the world? And that takes us to the back to the challenge. You know, we have to provide the food for the world that is nutritious, safe, affordable, accessible, and produced in a way that respects the earth, the animals, and the people. It's equally important to understand the triple bottom line of sustainability, the concept where companies who pursue sustainable businesses practices have a responsibility to measure the impact on people, the impact on planet, but understanding that sustainability can also improve profitability. It doesn't have to be a drain on profitability. And one other concept on sustainability before, you know, is an important concept to talk about: the three-legged stool. You know, you saw yesterday producers who raised the chickens, and you saw Lampkin's operation. You may not have seen the huge grain farms, you know, here in North Carolina, but those three entities are all joined at the hip. And if any one of those three partners cannot survive, then the other two will fail. Because we can't grow chickens the way a business, a farmer, can raise chickens and be incented to grow chickens. And, you know, back in the 70s, grain farmers were in trouble with $2 corn, and you heard a lot of bankruptcies and that were going on back then. You haven't heard that much lately here with $8 corn, but back then. In Maryland, producers, for example, got in trouble here a few years ago when the state of Maryland required that they could not put poultry litter on land if the phosphorus level is at a certain level. So how were they going to stay in business? So they were in jeopardy. And certainly, we refer to companies, you know, with the advent of the high-priced corn, we've had 10 to 12 companies go bankrupt in the United States. We went from 0% ownership outside the United States to now 25% of the industry is owned by outside foreign entities. And if one of these goes out of business, for example, there's a company here in North Carolina, Townsend, that was bought by a Ukrainian company, and then they closed their doors, and there were a number of farmers who still today do not have chickens and do not have an income in there. So that's an example of why this has to be a sustainable industry. Which brings us to local part. You know, corporate responsibility is measured by how we act locally. Consumers, customers, and communities are all the regulators really today. You know, and we need their trust if we want to operate. And corporate responsibility is really the new social contract. It's not no longer enough to simply provide economic benefits and pay workers, which was the original only thing a community wanted in a business. Today, there's a lot more emphasis on how we treat associates, how we care for the animals, take care of the environment, take care of the community, and support the community. And if you look at Tyson, Golden Pump, they have a corporate responsibility report, as we're coming out with one. So we're beginning to document now the impact on all these groups. And with many of our peers, you know, Purdue is developing a corporate sustainability into a platform where we believe in responsible food and agriculture. And we have four examples here, just as examples of where this can be beneficial. In our operations, we have now wellness centers on site. Doctors come into our wellness centers, as do dependents of the kids. Workers, and the key here is that when a worker makes an appointment to see an OBGYN or a orthopedic surgeon, while they leave the lines, wait in the office there at the building, and then go back to work, we pay them that whole time. So you take the excuse that I have to lose pay in order to see a doctor. And as a result of that, you know, we're for 15 years we've been doing this. Our healthcare cost has been pretty flat relative to the rest of the country. And that's because we're impacting chronic diseases like high blood pressure, sugar, weight, and smoking. Those are the four key areas, and also cholesterol. Those are the five areas that we measure on about 85% of our associates now, and that has an impact. As it relates to, we have a solar panel here that runs, on a good day, runs 90% of our electrical needs at our corporate office, and we also have a solar array at a feed mill in Delaware, which similarly is replacing fossil fuels. This is a facility in Kentucky, and in the background is the wastewater facility, which you saw yesterday, a wastewater facility, and that that tarp there is blowing up because of the methane that's going through a valve, and then a General Electric engine burns that and produces about 5 megawatts of electricity. That would run 800 homes for a year coming out of this facility, and reduces the CO2 by about 52,000 tons. And then another example here is, I mentioned the issue with the farmers on Delmarva who can't put their litter somewhere. So we built a facility down here in Delaware that processes up to about 400 chicken houses worth, can process up to 400 chicken houses worth a year of litter. And we make it into an organic fertilizer, and it's organic certified. And some of the examples of this group, Espoma, uses our product exclusively, and it's a brand new this year organic lawn fertilizer. And Scotts, he also uses our product, and a lot of organic vegetable growers. And the key here is that we go to their farms and take it out for free. We don't charge them for the litter, and we have people signed up who want to go this route for their litter. And so we've moved about 1 million tons over the last 11 years off of the Delmarva watershed, but more importantly, we've moved about 8 million pounds of nitrogen, 5 million pounds of phosphorus, and about 7 million pounds of potassium off the Delmarva Peninsula, and it's been redistributed somewhere else. So, and again, this is, I think, just an example of how you can act responsibly. But finally, this is the last slide. You know, there's those of us in the poultry industry will be the first to admit that we have had an image problem, and that's something I think we all need to deal with. And people trust farmers, but they don't necessarily trust agribusiness. And you know, we've allowed our adversaries sometimes to define us instead of us getting out and telling the world, you know, a lot of the good things that are going on in our industry. And of course, you know, yesterday, transparency is a key part of corporate responsibility. And yesterday was about as transparent as you can get, and thanks to Lampkin and his team. And that we have to do a lot more of that. I think Bill would agree. We love to take people through our operations because they have such a negative perception before they get there that you can't do anything but improve that perception because of what they've been told. So we have a good story to tell, and we really need your help, you know, to help tell that story, because it's a really success story that needs to be told. So thanks.
Good job, Jim. Thank you. My first question will be for Jim in just a moment, but please, as a reminder, looking forward to your questions, not my questions, but I want to get things started just a little bit. But seeing the organic fertilizer there, if anyone has seen my front yard, you know that I could use a couple bags of that. The other interesting thought was, if you talk to the farmer, to the grower, when he puts that litter on his field, he told me, or told the group that we were with, his corn yield per acre went up 62 bushels an acre. So, I mean, you know, this is not just fertilizer. This is good organic matter that really helps those nutrients move to the plant, whether it's corn or pasture or whatever. So it's not just moving it off the shore. It's moving it, hopefully, the yards like mine need it, but also the fields that can do that.
And, Bill, the key there is you know, people who get poultry litter love it because it is a wonderful fertilizer. One of the issues is nitrogen is soluble, so when it rains, it goes into the soil, and that's why the government normally looks at nitrogen. They've never looked at phosphorus, which is not soluble, so it stays on the surface. And application after application over 40, 50 years, phosphorus builds up, and then if there's a big runoff, it runs sideways into ditches and streams and creeks and rivers in the bay. So that's why, if the phosphorus level is a certain level, that's why they don't let them put that on there. But for brand new fields, I mean, you know, it is a wonderful, and it is a good fertilizer.
And not to drill down too far now, but just not to get too technical, but whether you're a farmer or have a front yard like mine, you need to test the soil. for nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and then you apply the fertilizer to meet the needs compared to what's in the soil.
And that's the nutrient management plan that all farmers have to submit.
Sometimes a challenge and sometimes an opportunity.
Right.
And Jim covered a number of things from a sustainability standpoint perhaps we hadn't thought about. But let me go back with Jim to sort of a basic question about the industry. How does our increased efficiency and productivity, the bird becoming more efficient in taking a pound of feed and turning it into meat, how important is that in terms of being more sustainable 5 years from now, 10 years from now, as compared to when, you know, we took 2.5 pounds of feed to make 1 pound of chicken? How does becoming more efficient intersect with being more sustainable compared to, not to pick on beef and hogs, but let's pick on them. comparatively speaking, if we can use fewer resources and get the same or more output, isn't that somehow being more sustainable too?
Sure. Bill talked about the two feed conversion of two pounds of feed to a pound of meat, and that used to be 4, and it used to be 12 weeks to grow a chicken to the same size we're growing it today. So through better housing, better nutrition, better genetics, you know, we've been able to improve that efficiency, and that uses less corn. It uses less inputs in order to get the same amount of meat. You know, and of course, chickens are the most efficient of the pork, beef, which you all use more corn. And that's why China, for example, is focused on chicken, because they know their corn crop will be more, there'll be more protein produced by chicken than it will be by pork. And that's why they're quickly changing as fast as they can to a chicken-based production. The only more thing efficient than a chicken is a fish, you know, in aquaculture. And they're about a 1.1 to 1.2 efficiency. And, of course, the main reason is because they don't have to worry about gravity. A fish floats in water, truthfully, and it doesn't have to have a big skeleton like we have to fight gravity. So that's why it's very efficient in converting its feed.
Good. Yeah. Bill, if I could add to that just a tad. So I think you used the word candid a while ago. Not everyone's that nice. Generally speaking, it takes about 18 pounds of feed to produce a pound of boneless. Let's get it on a boneless basis. Boneless beef, 18 pounds of feed, okay? About 11 pounds of feed for a pound of boneless pork, and only about 3 pounds of feed for a pound of boneless chicken. And as Jim mentioned, it takes much less time now to grow a chicken to 4 pounds or 8 pounds. We can grow a 4 pound chicken today with genetics that we have and the nutrition that we use in about 35 days, 34 days in some cases. And it used to take us 6 weeks. So we don't have the land tied up as long. We can produce more pounds per acre. Jim mentioned we're going to have a globe and a half to meet the demands of a 9 billion people population. So that's why chicken is the better protein from that standpoint.
Good, thank you for that. And just to pick up on that idea a moment, thank you, Ben. We didn't see it yesterday, we talked about it, but there's farms that have breeder hens, and these are the mother hens that lay the fertile eggs that we saw going into incubators yesterday. And these hens are becoming more and more productive. They lay more eggs, the eggs they lay hatch at a higher rate than they used to. The livability of the chicks is greater. And then at the end of the processing line, the yield of meat from these birds, am I saying it right, is higher. So we talk about feed conversion, but when you go back to the breeder hen, it's been phenomenal. And when you talk to the genetic companies, and it's a handful of them, there's not that many anymore, but they're global because of the size they need. So they tell me you take 10,000 possible mother hens that are going to go into the next generation. Out of those 10,000, they select 300. That's the selection process. I mean, it's harder to be a mother hen than it is to get into Harvard. So you go from 10,000 applicants and only 300. Now, how do they choose the 300? Well, I'm not a geneticist, so I really shouldn't talk about it, but since I'm a humble moderator, I will. At least what I think I know about it. Well, first they look at it, but then they give it all kinds of tests, MRIs and blood tests and look at the how the genetics came together. And so the next generation of hens, those 300, go on to be the next productive group of hens. People say, why don't we clone? Well, clone maybe is possible, but cloning only gets you where you are. You duplicate what you have. In the chicken industry, we don't want to be where we are. We want to be better the next time. And so that's why we have this tremendous pressure for the next generation to really get the next most productive birds.
And don't forget about SAT scores.
Or Salisbury State business school. One other quick question, Jim. On sustainability, how do you deliver that message to the consumer? Do you try and do a soft sell, get the halo effect, or do you say, okay, on our social media, we want to let you know that our company's doing these things, or you just do it because it's the right thing to do, or do you say, okay, there's an opportunity here if we tell our story? Consumers may take a second look at our chicken package as opposed to the competition. How do you see that dovetailing?
Well, trust is the key, as we had up on the slide, you know, for being corporate responsible. But how you engender that trust is critical. And, you know, in the old days, I mean, like when my dad got on TV, I mean, that was engendering trust in a sense because the owner of the company was saying something. But today, even that doesn't necessarily work. I think third party is an important, you know, if you get third party endorsement from whether it's an auditing group that audits you for, like USDA has a process verified program, you know, where they'll verify that what you say is what it is. You give them the program, and then they'll come in and audit. And then there's a lot of audits related to organic and, you know, that you can get. So trying to get some third-party endorsement. But social media, again, is the new, I mean, that's, you can't control the message anymore. The message is out there, but you have to address the message. And so social media obviously is a key difference today. And the old days of just advertising only, that was it. You know, it's a new world and a new ballgame on getting our message out there.
Do people read what's on the package if you deliver some of this information on the package?
I think some do. I mean, you know, you have your value buyer who, they're looking for one thing. It depends, you know, you have people, but you have a lot more people who are interested in what's in that package, you know, what's, especially on further processed items, you know, the they like to see words that they can pronounce. They don't like words that end in A-T-E, you know, they don't. So, you know, so coming out with simpler components that you can buy at a grocery store on the package, those things like that are very, very important today to consumers. They'll tell you that, and I think they'll put their money where their mouth is too. But there are people obviously who are going to buy value. That's what all they're going to go in and buy. And so,
thanks, Jim. I'm getting some good questions, so keep them coming. One question for Bill, and I'm going to do this in sort of round numbers, so don't say this is exactly right. But you talked about the value of the front of the bird, back of the bird, back of the bird becoming more important. So in round numbers, let's say it costs $1 a pound to produce a pound of ready-to-cook chicken, of Israeli chicken in the package. Let's say it costs $1 a pound, and it's probably somewhat less than that today with corn prices down. And let's say boneless skinless breast is $1.50, and the leg quarters are, say, 50 cents. Okay, so we're getting more value from the back of the bird, but 50 cents is still not a dollar. So in a sense, we are, let's say, subsidizing the consumer who loves the dark meat, which is a lot of the world consumers and some of the consumers here in the United States. But I guess the question is, do you see, you know, you say perhaps increased demand for the dark meat, do you see that equation continuing in the future where the back of the bird really can contribute more to that dollar a pound overall cost?
Absolutely. As we talked about, I think, on our bus yesterday, boneless, skinless thigh meat is one of the fastest growing products that's sold fresh at retail today. I think actually 2011, 2012, it was the product that sold at a greater growth rate. The price of boneless, skinless thigh meat today is within, you know, not very many pennies per pound as breast meat. So definitely, at least in this country, we're seeing more value being created by behind me. You've also noticed, if you're a connoisseur of the Food Network and other cooking shows, you notice chefs today are using more and more thymine. We talked about sodium content as it relates to health, and the fact that if thymine naturally has more fat and therefore more flavor, then in some cases you can make an argument that you don't have to use as much salt or other ingredients for the taste. So I think there's a lot of promise and a lot of prospects for leg meat growing here in the U.S. Conversely, we're beginning to see demand for white meat in countries that we historically didn't see that from. And so we're exporting a lot of white meat. I'm speaking for our company specifically. We're exporting much more white meat today than we ever have, and it's growing. So I think, and I can't tell you the exact time on the calendar when this is going to happen, but I think you're going to see those values of white and leg meat converge at some point, both from the global demand for white meat and the domestic demand for leg meat both increase at the same time.
Good, Bill. And we've been talking about parts. Let me just ask a quick question about the whole carcass chicken. Rotisserie chickens, basically a whole carcass, and I, at least in my stores, I think I'm seeing more features of whole birds. Are whole birds disappearing? Are they coming back? Are they staying steady? I mean, we talk about the parts, but what about the traditional whole bird that a lot of us love to put in the oven and roast?
Well, I would tell you that's also been a huge growth category, especially at retail in the delis. Rotisserie chickens that are fully cooked and sold at the retail deli are growing tremendously. That's a great value. I mean, you can in some markets pick up a fully cooked chicken for around $5 to $7 a pound. Take it home, and it's more than one meal occasion. And we're seeing now for the first time consumers who go to a supermarket for the sole purpose of picking up a couple of chickens, maybe a couple of sides, and then going home, and so having a meal occasion with their family, but yet, you know, they can use that as an ingredient for the next, you know, 2, 3, 4 days to take to work. And we continue to see more and more demand, and I think the market price reflects that. The Georgia Dock today, I believe lambkins $1.275, almost $1.03 per pound. A couple of years ago, it was in the mid 80s. So definitely seen increased demand and price for the whole birds.
Good, thank you, Bill. Question for Lampkin. You talked about the price of corn being $8, $9, and certainly that's a challenge for us. But what keeps you awake at night? Is it the $8 or $9 price of corn, or is it $8 or $9 this month, and then next month it's $6? That volatility, how do you try and manage that, or is it impossible to manage volatility? You just have to take your best shot when you think the time is right.
Well, we say it's unknowable. You just don't know. You just have to be prepared to deal with what comes along. And because our business is cyclical, it's important to have a strong balance sheet so you don't stay awake at night and worry about that. You weather through that storm. The price of corn is right now is the planting season for the farmers, and we saw the same scenario last year. The farmers this time of year, the USDA projected they were going to plant 94 million acres, which was a record at that time. And the farmers did end up planting 91 million, which is a lot of acres. But the weather didn't cooperate. This time last year, everybody was so optimistic that we were going to get some relief from corn prices. And then by June, there was a drought in the Midwest, and the corn crop didn't materialize. Instead of 164 bushel yield, it ended up being 124, and we were right back to expensive grain. So you never know. You just have to be prepared to deal with it when it comes. But we're sitting on a similar situation right now in that 2 weeks ago, USDA projected 97 million acres of would be planted in corn this year. And now, last year we had a real early plant. The weather was perfect and the farmers planted early. We just didn't get cooperation from Mother Nature and the moisture didn't arrive. This year there's going to be a late plant because there's been a lot of late snow and some late winter in some of the corn growing regions. So now there's a late plant and we'll see what develops from that.
Good point. I don't think anyone's panicked yet about the late planting of corn, but compared to last year, there's concern because this time last year, a lot of corn was planted. This time this year, as Lampkin said, not too much corn has been planted, and not being a farmer as such, but my understanding is if you don't get your corn in on time, then you start to think about alternative crops, which would be soybeans, which certainly we need too. But the next few weeks will keep not only the chicken industry very interested in how much corn gets planted, but also does it get in the ground? Is the soil warm? Does it get generated? Do we have nice moisture to get that crop going? So we'll be watching that very much. The other point about corn prices and volatility, and correct me, Lampkin, but normally at harvest, that is the lowest price of corn because all the corn is coming to market at one time. Farmers want to get it off their farm. And so normally, 9 times out of 10, that's the best time to buy corn because the price is going to be the lowest. Well, last year, that was the thinking, because we had a relatively small crop because of drought. But correct me, Lampkin, if you bought your corn at harvest last year, that turned out to be the worst time to buy it, because that was the highest price. Because people looked at supply and demand and said, okay, it's going to go up from here. Well, not everything happened the way it's supposed to. So the price of corn kept going up. It started to go down. And so trying to say, okay, buying at harvest is the best idea, that doesn't always work either. Like you say, it's unknowable in terms of...
Well, people make these decisions every day, and you just cannot be right every time. I mean, it's just there are too many moving parts and too many factors, and you do the best you can.
A couple of other questions, Lampkin. You mentioned food service demand, and also, too, thank you. We have seen, or at least I have seen in the press, some analysts say, well, finally the consumer has moved from high-priced beef to chicken. Now, we thought that was going to happen a couple of years ago when the price of beef started going up, but we didn't see so much of that. But something has happened late last year and so far this year where we've seen a bit of a shift from beef to chicken. And I think some of it's been in food service, some in retail. Would you agree with that, Mike?
I do agree that we're seeing that right now. And I'll tell you that we get asked that question from investors a lot about competing proteins. And until, as you said, Bill, in the fall and this year, we've always said we would rather compete against expensive beef and pork, obviously. But at the end of the day, we think it's a we've always thought it was not a huge factor because consumers are not going to eat chicken every day. They're going to consume all the proteins over a period of a week or 2 weeks. And we've never thought it had a huge impact other than if beef and pork are high, we get more features, which is good as far as demand and moving product. But it does seem to have been a change in that recently. Beef and pork are at all-time highs, and we're seeing excellent demand for fresh chicken at retail grocery stores throughout, even since 07 and 08. The consumers that aren't going to restaurants are still buying chicken at the grocery store, so that's been very good. But last 3 or 4 months has been even better, and our customers attribute that to the price relative to beef and pork. We're also seeing, I know y'all look at the economic numbers like we all do, unemployment is down to 7.7%, but there are a lot of people that have removed themselves from even availability for work. So there's still too many people not working, but we're feeling better demand out there. It's reflecting in the prices that we're getting for our distributor business, for the food service business. We're seeing it in those markets, and it's a small indication that not the economy is back to perfect, but that there are some improvements out there.
Yeah, I think the example is you got Burger King, Wendy's with a turkey burger now, and McDonald's is considering it, and I don't think you would have seen that long ago. But they don't want to promote beef because I think of the price they're having to pay. So that's a sea change, I think. Turkey burgers is getting on the menus.
Turkey burger this year, chicken burger next year, or
yeah. Sir. Sounds good to me.
Bill. On the cattle cycle in the U.S., let the world worry about the world, but in the United States, where do you see the cattle cycle? Are we still going down in terms of number of head? And what's it going to take to turn that cattle cycle around? And when it does turn around, when are we going to see more beef, more competition from the red meat sector?
So the direct answer is yes, we are seeing the cattle supply continuing to decline. And, you know, normally there's one thing that affects the cattle supply as it goes through its cycle, and that's price. So as high as feeder cattle are today, as high as fed cattle are today to packers, you would think that price serves as an incentive for those cattlemen that own mother cows to retain more heifers and build the supply back. To a small degree, and very small degree, that's happening. But here's sort of the overarching concern in the cattle business. The average age of the cattleman now is mid-60s or even older. The average herd size is about 30 head. So as we've seen a continued migration of our population go away from agriculture in terms of sheer numbers, there's just not as many people that are interested in continuing to be in the cattle business. And the other thing, the drought that we've had, it's not just last year, but it's been going on in the plains of Texas, West Texas, Western Kansas, Western Nebraska. It's been going on for 3 or 4 years. And so that's shifted the cattle from one region to the other. And the question is, will those cattle come back to those regions? It's been in the news recently that Cargill, one of the largest beef packers in the U.S., recently closed a plant in the Texas Panhandle. Why? Because the supply of cattle in the Texas Panhandle and the areas that fed those plants shifted, and the cattle just weren't there. And even with one less plant today, there's still a shortage of cattle, and that's been reflected in the price of the live cattle, and that's frankly why beef is at a historic high right now. So I think that's going to continue to answer your question.
Just briefly on hogs, pork supply, pretty steady, not so much up and down.
Actually, the pork business is an interesting business as well, and actually here in Eastern North Carolina, there's a large presence of hog growing in the U.S. It's very cyclical. It's very sensitive to the price of corn and soybean meal, just like the chicken business is. And I think it was late 2008, 2009, the hog production business became very unprofitable, had some bankruptcies. The herd, the supply of hogs went down. It you know, the business got better, obviously, and was profitable in 2010, 2011. But in 2012, we started to see the same thing when we had the drought. The corn went past $8, as we talked about before. So that's a very cyclical business. Supply right now is about even with last year, maybe a little bit ahead, but through strong export demand for the product, the prices have also remained very high.
Good. A lot of good questions here. We're going to get to in just a moment. Let me ask the panel if there's anything you'd like to add or say, or I missed before we go to the questions? All right, Lampkin, first question for you, and the person that asked the question was much more gentle and diplomatic about how they asked the question, but I'll ask it this way. We keep complaining about corn prices. Why don't you put something else in your feed besides corn that's less expensive to feed the chickens?
There is no substitute today. You can blend in some wheat or milo. I mean, there's some substitutes, but frankly, where we're located, we don't have access to wheat. I mean, our nutritionist would try to price that in every day, but we just couldn't get it there at a number that would work. But there's such a cost involved in feeding these chickens and the feed conversions. And if you tried to substitute something else, or if you change that ration, it could be more expensive to produce. There's just today there's not a substitute that would make economic sense versus corn and soybean meal.
Just one second, Bill, but would the flavor or taste of chicken a little bit different if we use wheat instead of corn, or would it not be that?
I don't think it would for wheat. You guys may know more.
I don't think so. We have some locations that do feed wheat. Now, the inclusion of wheat in a chicken's diet can only go so high because of digestibility. And so there's not enough wheat that goes in that would impart a different flavor to answer your question. But, you know, the other thing that we could talk about, too, is historically we fed, you know, U.S. number two yellow corn to our chickens. Well, because of the drought last year and because of the increased demand and less supplier in the U.S., we began for the first time importing corn from South America. And we've been very public about this. We're going to import and feed about 10% of our needs, pilgrims, from late December to July of Argentine and Brazilian corn. We made an investment in a U.S. port to import that corn. And as we've had huge crops of corn from Argentina and Brazil this past crop year, their crop year ends or is harvested in March, I think we're going to see continued pressure from a price standpoint of Brazilian and Argentine and corn from other parts of the world. The Ukraine, for example, is probably going to produce double their needs of wheat and corn this year. And we've seen a lot of wheat come into the port of Wilmington, North Carolina, not very far from here. Smithfield has said that they have hogs that have never eaten corn. They've been feeding them imported wheat, and they've imported a lot of corn as well. So the dynamics of our feed ingredient complex is changing. We're becoming more of a world market today than we ever have.
We hear the term unintended consequences. When the ethanol industry really kicked in 2006, I don't think the corn farmers thought that we would be importing corn in large amounts. We've only imported a little bit of corn, but one of the unintended consequences is, as you've indicated, if you can buy corn from Brazil or Argentina from another country and bring it in, it's less expensive, especially in the southeastern United States where poultry and some of the hogs are. From an economic standpoint, you're going to do that. If you're a corn farmer in the Midwest, you're probably scratching your head and rethinking about whether or not $8 a bushel of corn is a good idea, because the $8 in the United States is the world price. So it doesn't just encourage more acres in the United States, it encourages more acres all around the world where you can produce corn or competing crop. So it's a good point in terms of thinking about the initial impact of something and then the longer term impact. Jim, the other question on this card was, what makes fertilizer organic? Does USDA have a standard that you have to meet to be able to put organic on your fertilizer, or is it a self-imposed voluntary standard, or how does that work?
Well, there's an organization called OMRI, and they're the ones that certify, and they have actually look at the components in the feed. For example, it's not a few years ago, You know, there's a big question about arsenic, and arsenic was used to control some things, and it's not being used today. We stopped using it a number of years ago, but they check arsenic. They look for the level of arsenic in that fertilizer, and so it has to be basically background level. And so we had to use our litter because, you know, we couldn't use it. We were using anybody's litter, but we had to switch totally to our litter to go through the organic fertilizer. So they look at all the, they do an analysis of what's in it, and they certify you.
So a consumer can be very confident, at least buying the brand you had here, that if it says organic, it means...
Yeah, you'll see the Omri seal on the bags of the Escoma and Scotts when they're organic, yeah.
Good. And if you're an organic corn farmer, you have to figure out, maybe can't afford the kind of fertilizer we have here, but the organic corn farmer has to use either green crops or something, but they can't use regular commercial fertilizer and get organic corn or organic soybeans, whatever.
That's right. And remember, it's a real challenge for a farmer because it takes him 3 years to get from this year to organic certified corn. So, you know, he can't use pesticides, herbicides, and that sort of thing So getting those through those first 2 years is part of the challenge of converting to an organic corn farm.
And the lower yields on organic corn is the challenge. Rule of thumb on organic corn, twice as costly, three times as costly as commercial corn?
Twice. Yeah.
Because of the yield.
$16 a bushel, when you heard $8 a bushel. And remember, a large quantity of it comes from offshore. You know, we're bringing a lot of it in from Turkey and other places. And soybean meal, 80% of the organic soybean meal comes from offshore.
$16 a bushel for organic corn, and it's not grown here, so is it certified by us?
It's USDA's.
Let me repeat the question. Oh. Okay, so the question is, regular corn, let's say, is $8 a bushel, organic corn is $16 a bushel. Well, I would suggest it's all of $16, and because not enough organic corn is here, we have to import it, which raises the question, how do we know that that's really organic, or has someone in another country said, yeah, here's a piece of paper that says organic. So wrestle with that.
It has a USDA certification. Now, whether that's inspected actually in the country of Turkey or not, but there is USDA offices there, and so they certify that the source of that was. But I think going forward, you know, we're going to be doing our own, you know, talking about transparency. I think it's critically important that be transparent, because it also has to be GMO-free, which is even more of a challenge.
Genetically modified, which means...
Genetically modified, right.
And not just corn, but the soybean meal, anything you put in that feed
right. Has
to be organic. So you can't be a little bit organic, you have to be 100% organic.
That's right.
Can I ask
yes.
A follow-up, Jim? So in order to produce organic fertilizer, are you feeding your chickens organic meal? And if not, what makes it organic?
Yeah, do that again.
Okay. So I'm just a little perplexed about how you can generate organic fertilizer when the chickens are not fed an organic meal.
No, that's not a requirement in Omri. They just take the product itself and do an analysis on that and on what is in the litter. But they don't. It doesn't have to come from an organically grown animal to be organic fertilizer. Actually, I mean, chicken manure is organic fertilizer. Truthfully, I mean it is, and that's why it's a great fertilizer to use.
I guess it's just different distinctions about when you talk about organic food, it has to be grown with certain requirements, so that litter maybe or fertilizer has different standards.
Right, but remember, this has gone through the metabolic system of the chicken. It's not going in and coming out looking exactly the same way. So, you know, the chicken processes that.
I have a question here on, we talked about the chicken becoming more productive and more efficient, and I think that's a very good question, and I don't know that we really addressed it that well. So the question is, okay, your chicken's getting more feed efficient, more productive, and so on.
But hey, what about us, the consumers? What about taste, flavor, quality of the meat? How are we addressing that as we try and make the chicken a more productive bird? Who would like to answer that one?
Why not? So, you know, if you look at the trade-off of taste and nutrition and healthiness, in most cases, we can achieve a great-tasting product that's very nutritious, low in relatively low in sodium, salt, relatively low in saturated fats and other ingredients. As Jim said, consumers are increasingly looking for ingredients in the product that they're familiar with. If it's an ingredient on the product that sounds like a chemical, it raises questions, it raises concern. Not that at all there's anything wrong with it or it's unsafe. I think it's the unknown more than anything else. I know a lot of our customers, we're a big supplier to food service industry, and a lot of our customers are looking to us to develop products that are lower in salt, for example. And if we put breading on products, they're looking for whole grain breadings to make it nutritious, create the perception of greater nutrition. So yes, that's going on more and more as we speak. On the other hand, I think the most important thing is about choice. Not all consumers want the same thing. If you look at the different retailers, they all have their sort of core customers. And certain retailers, their average customer spends perhaps $60 a week. Others may spend $100 a week. And if you're looking at that value consumer, then that value consumer may be looking for something different than a consumer that where price is not as much of a purchase factor.
Thanks, Bill. We have time for just a couple more questions. I want to apologize that I won't be able to ask all the questions I have here. So during the break or before the folks leave today, if you really have that burning question, I'm sure they'll try and address it one-on-one. But it's now time for the question that we ask at every meeting like this. And where's Nancy? This question has, the first one I ever attended, this question was asked at every meeting like this that we've had this question. Does anyone want to guess what that question is? Okay, the question is, why are the chicken breasts so big? Why can't we get a small chicken breast? Mr. Butts.
Well, you can. As Bill mentioned earlier, there's plenty of variety and plenty of options, different consumers have different requests and desires. We get the question often about chickens, why are chickens so big? And we mentioned this yesterday, people always think that's hormones and steroids, and nobody in our industry uses hormones and steroids. It's prohibited by federal law, so it's not that. The fact is that in our industry, the segment of our industry that produces birds for the fast food industry, that's basically a 4-pound live weight. It's smaller than what you saw yesterday. That's the same size bird because the fast food operators have specifications, and to meet that, those birds are the same size they have been for many, many years. And most of those are going to the fast food restaurants or the retail deli, but that's still there. If you look at the other segments, like product pack for retail grocery stores and products deboned for food service, those bird weights have gone up. They've gone up incrementally in small increments each year. And it's just from a cost perspective. The cost of everything we do goes up. A lot of what we do goes up annually with wages and different parts of our business, salaries and benefits, hospitalization. And a way to offset that inflationary cycle is just to move bird weights up a little bit. I mentioned choices. We do have consumers that ask for a smaller chicken. When our chickens were smaller, we had consumers that wanted a plumper chicken. I want more meat on the bone. And today, the food service distributors buy, the boneless breast they buy is much larger than what you see in a grocery store. But when that product gets in the restaurateur is cutting that into smaller pieces for tender strips or chunks on salad, and it's used in different ways. But the heavy bird is just a business reaction to offset costs.
Thank you, Lampkin. And Jim, let me ask you to pick up on that, because we see it in our marketplace in the Baltimore, Washington area. Your company has, I think, some products that I would suggest are addressing that concern about our breast too big. I need a portion that's more manageable, that I know I can cook more quickly. What has your company done to help consumers there?
Well, my mother passed away last year, but that was because of her. She was giving me a very hard time about the size of chickens. But truthfully, it's an example, though, where if you listen to the customer and or the consumer, and they were telling us that, so we developed a product that is a certain portion size and put it in a sealed wrap, you know, which they would found out that they were doing anyway. They were putting it in a bag, you can throw it in the freezer. So if you do it for them, so I mean, if you give the consumer what they want, they'll buy it, and it's been a good product line. Because I think it hit a need. But to Lampkin's point, you know, the cost of that chicken is, you take all the meat in that plant, you divide it in all the cost. And if you run Cornish hens in there at 2 pounds, it's still all that meat divided into the cost. And so it's a lot more expensive for a smaller bird. So either the consumer's going to have to learn to pay more for, you know, that smaller bird, because it's the costs are just keep going up year after year.
Good, thank you.
Bill?
Go ahead.
These gentlemen did a great job with that, so I'm not going to address it. But I would make a suggestion that our program would be somewhat incomplete if our media guests left without their questions being answered. So may I suggest that if you have unanswered questions, could we submit those back to the group, either in writing or on the internet, if we could do that?
If you heard Tom shake his head, he said yes. So we will do that. Thank you. But one last question. We are out of time, but it's really in the news, and I think we need to reassure not just the folks in this room, but everybody in the media and all the consumers. And this question has to do with the avian influenza that we're seeing in China. And Bill, I'm looking at you, but if anybody else would like to pick up on that. What do we know about H7N9 bird flu in China? Is it a threat to consumers here? Is it a threat to our poultry? Is it going to be contained in China? And if you can do it in 1 or 2 minutes.
Sure, thank you, Bill. Well, we know very little about the specific H7N9 virus. And when you hear that or see the term avian flu, it can be a confusing term because there's so many strains. And H7N9 is a very different virus than perhaps H7N2 or H5N1. What we have here in terms of viruses in the U.S. is very different than what's in China. So you've probably seen that, I believe there have been 38 cases, I want to say, of this disease in humans in China. But 40% of those affected had no contact with poultry or fowl. So it's interesting. You know, how it started, how it spread. It's a new virus, hadn't been detected before. So I think the Chinese officials are very busy trying to learn more about this. Read this morning they've identified a family in Shanghai where they think it started, and they're investigating maybe the movement of the family and trying to piece together what happened. We've never seen that virus here in the U.S. I would tell you, in my opinion, that with our biosecurity measures that we take both as an industry and as a government, we're very well protected, but we're also very diligent. We're not going to assume
anything, we're going to make sure that we maintain our biosecurity efforts and keep out any viruses and any agent that has the potential to be harmful.
Just to follow up on that, our industry, we had a serious avian influenza like they're having in China here, 5 years? I can't remember how long ago it was, but we decided as an industry we're going to check every flock before it comes into the poultry plant for avian influenza, and that's done routinely in our industry now. What worries me is you're seeing more and more backyard flocks, people who in the city, you know, they want to have 5 or 6 chickens, and where we ran into a real problem in this country at that time was the live bird markets in New York and Boston, of which there were 30 to 50. And 70% of those were positive for avian influenza, because it's the same kind of live bird markets in China where this stuff just generates itself and you can never get out of the cycle. And it wasn't until the USDA finally cracked down in New York, and if they found a positive, you had to be out of chickens or off, I think maybe all animals, I'm not sure, in that market for 1 week and clean it, and then they'd let you start up again. And now they're down to, I don't know, Bruce, they're below 3 or 4% positive some on avian influenza in those markets. So one of my worries is the proliferation of small backyard flocks that are totally unchecked, as our chickens are checked, is a big concern, because that's where we'll get started, probably.
Just one thing to add to that. You heard us mention yesterday biosecurity, and you saw the gear that we all wore on the farm and in the hatchery. That's what that program, that biosecurity that our whole industry does, is designed to protect us from a pathogen like what they're seeing in China right now. The contained house, the sealed house, the ventilated and temperature controlled house, from a biosecurity standpoint, this addresses what Jim's saying about backyard flocks or free range chickens. That is the right biosecurity to protect those animals from a problem like that.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest. Thank you for your great questions. We will follow up with the questions that we weren't able to ask. I will ask Tom to come back and tell us what to do here in a moment during our break. But please join me now in thanking Jim and Bill and Landon for